So welcome to Harlem 411, where you get the real deal about what's happening in Harlem. Learn about empowerment opportunities at HCCI and meet the movers and shakers in the Harlem community. Harlem 411 is hosted by me, Moikanti Kama, Director of Communications and Development, and
Donald Lawrence, Director of Residence and Community Services at HCCI.
Today we are joined by an amazing Harlem leader. Her name is Sister Aisha Sekou. She is founder of Street Corner Resources, a nonprofit established to promote peace among youth in the Harlem community.
Today's discussion is really about our youth, and particularly those who would be considered at risk, those who are formerly incarcerated and are reentering society, and the supports these young people need to reach their potential and live happy, meaningful, fulfilling lives.
So let's start with Sister Aisha Sekou, founder and CEO of Street Corner Resources. Sister, I have known you for many, many years.
Many years.
As we went over this the other day on the radio. We're just piggybacking with the radio shows. but you know, when I initially learned about your work and learned that you would literally interrupt violent interactions in the street between youth at night in the streets, I thought, number one, this sister is incredibly brave. Number two, no, really, I was just like, this is a brave sister. She's, wow. Number two, you deeply love our children. And you are the type of person that Che Guevara was talking about when he said, the true revolutionary is guided by a great feeling of love. You know, you volunteered to do one of the toughest jobs in society, which is to connect with young people when they're adrenaline-fueled, angry, and probably the most difficult to reach. And so, you know, I really admire you and commend you and thank you for that work. You know, and so my first question for you is, what gave you the strength and the heart and the courage to do what you do?
You know, one, I want to thank you for having me on your show, and both you and Brother Lawrence, thank you both. The thing that gave me the strength and the courage to do this work, I might be a little crazy, so we'll start there. But I grew up in an activist household, and so my mother, I come from a mother who always helped and served, and we always had people staying in our homes, and it was like nothing that, I mean, it just didn't seem like anything odd for me to do, and because my mother always taught me that if there's a problem and it's bothering you, then you should be doing something about it. And the thing that bothered me was two separate incidences, but both kids were like about 13 years old, young people, 13 years old, and they were murdered at two different times. And then there were a host of other shootings with young people. And I just felt like, you know.
What year was
that? I think the first shooting was probably, probably somewhere in the year 2000. I think that was Scotty Scott.
Okay.
In the year 2000. But there were other things that happened before then, because I ran a welfare to work program called Begin for women who were on public assistance, and their sons and daughters were both getting caught up in violence. So that was my first point. But I think that the murders that we began to see in Harlem with young people killing each other, the first one was over a crap game that I paid a particular attention to, because this young person was only 13 years old. And he acted like he had money he didn't have, and he was shot in the game. And then there were a whole host of other shootings that happened that were just, you know, any shooting is horrible. But there are some that just resonate and have resonated in my spirit. It was a 17-year-old young man on 141st Street, I think it was. He was a Blood gang member. Again, 17, he had just had a baby, and he really wanted to change his way of being. And so he said that he wanted to get out of the gang. And they told him he couldn't, and they told him to meet him. They wanted to talk to him about it, and they shot him in the back of his head. That ran on the internet in the New York Post site for a while, and people were posting it because it came off of the camera from the building and people had access to that.
Oh,
it was just running on the internet of him getting shot. So, you know, you could see that over and over again. So those kinds of killings were, you know, resonated strongly with me and made me feel like I could do something, like I could at least try to do something. And I just, it just started. It's kind of amazing how it developed, but it was, you know, along with other people from the Harlem community, I wound up meeting people who also had the same interests and were appalled by the number of shootings, and we just started making plans and went on the street and started talking with young people and figuring out ways. We had plenty of meetings, Pastor Williams, Brother Abdul Kareem Muhammad, a few women, and, you know, the group got bigger and bigger, and we started engaging more people and just looking at strategies and ways to eliminate the violence or begin to stop the violence that we were seeing an increase on. So,
And how long have you been doing
the courage and the strength comes from my mom. I'll just say that. Say that again.
Okay. How long have you been doing this work?
A long time.
It sounds like 19 years from what you said.
Yeah, and probably before that. I know that the one particular shooting that stays in my mind happened around 2000. But I've been working with young people for over 30-some-odd years. And so the issue of violence kind of it wasn't as bad as we see now, but it was always some semblance or some form of violence happening with young people, but not at the magnitude that we see. So particularly gun violence began to increase somewhere in the 90s, toward the late 90s, toward 2000. We saw an increase. So it's been a good while, probably almost 20-something years.
Okay.
But the way that we're doing it now is very different. So this is more defined and on purpose, and we follow a model. And so it took a while to get to this point, just trying to figure out what to do, how to do it, you know, how to engage young people, how to engage the community, and to get them to understand that violence is a serious issue. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, 20 years, 20-some-odd years, a long time.
That's cool. In your experience, what leads kids to participate in violence?
Well, you know, I truly believe that there's no kid that really says, I want to be violent. What happens is the situations and circumstances and oftentimes mental health issues kind of force them to, you know, they're forced to be in situations, or sometimes because of where they live and how they live, violence becomes part of that living. So, for example, a young person living in the projects, and maybe the family gets evicted, and now that kid who, the young person who grew up in that particular community or development, is now away from his friends and family members and is maybe living in a shelter. But they go back to the projects because they want to be around their friends, and they're allowed to stay in a gang house, what's called the gang house. And in order to stay in that gang house, you have to do what they call put in work, meaning that you have to participate in violent acts on behalf of the gang. So that's one way. Homelessness can lead to a young person being in violent situations. Shelter living, overcrowded shelters with people with all kinds of mental health issues, and young people are forced to have to begin to protect themselves from other kids from other places. Those kinds of situations lead to violence. Also, mental health issues. Our kids are being exposed over and over again on the internet to violence. They're also playing video games sometimes more than 8 hours a day. And a lot of young people, unbeknownst to parents, stay up all night playing video games. So if you play killing games, what I call killing games, and what the military would basically refer to as killing games, right? So in the military, when they first created these video games, They created these video games to teach people in the military to shoot, not how to shoot, but to be able to shoot and desensitize. And so these same video games are what we see in homes today that young people are playing for 8 hours. So those video games desensitize. They create a mindset of a shooter. And so if
right.
you practice anything for 8 hours every day, you begin to get good at it. Mm-hmm. You can almost do it without thinking. And
mm-hmm.
and that's another way that violence happens. And, of course, your bullying that you see on the Internet, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, social media itself plays a major part in young people participating in violence because who they are is a lot of it is defined by what they put on social media and how
mm-hmm.
other people view them on social media. There is a YouTube channel that's called The CC Show. And The CC Show is relatively new. I think it's been out for about 2 or 3 months, and it's been out before, and Facebook took it down. But you'll see young people engaging in violent conversation often, and they talk, they have beef right there on the show. And a young
uh-huh.
person showed this. You know, most of what I learn from young people, right, who have been engaged in, you know, violent behavior, they're around it. And you can see right on this show, people are talking about, I'm outside. When you say I'm outside, it's like a
right.
challenge to the other person. You come outside because I'm looking for you and I'm not hiding from you. And so
right.
violence happens a lot because of how we're using social media and a lot of, you know, the internet networks and how it's being promoted within that, you know, within a show or a blog or what have you. So
I think that's
so
really
many different
point.
Things that lead to violence.
Uh-huh.
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's really an important point because I think sometimes people want to link violence to poverty specifically or, you know,
mm-hmm.
black community specifically. But when you look
mm-hmm.
at what's happening in the nation, you know, the mass shootings are not really taking place by us and they're not taking place by, you know, poor kids. It's kids
no,
who have been desensitized to violence and exposed to all of this, you know, the killing videos, like you said,
uh-huh.
and killing games. So, I mean, I think that's really an excellent point
no
to kind of highlight.
You know, and the other part of that is the availability of guns. So you can't
right.
shoot if you don't have the gun, right?
Right.
And so...
Right.
Because guns are becoming more and more accessible in our community,
mm-hmm.
you can get a gun faster than you can get the PlayStation or the Xbox or what have you. In most communities, these kids know exactly where to get the gun. There's no age
mm-hmm.
limit on who can buy it. These kids are buying
mm-hmm.
what's called a collective gun. So if
yeah.
me, you, and Brother Lawrence, we're all down together, you know, we're friends, and we know we got to look out, we got to protect our hood, that we put our money together and purchase a gun. That gun gets moved from house to house or person to person depending on need.
Mm.
Very interesting. They are more
and that's how our young people get access to guns. So because they're so available and because they play killing games, it puts the gun in the hand of the mind-trained shooter, and it's so easy for them to pull a trigger. But what they don't have is consequential thinking. So they don't think about the
yeah.
consequences that's going to happen in this 5 seconds that it takes for me to pull this trigger. Those 5 seconds will get you 25. So I always talk with young people about 5 will get you 25, and they think it's gambling. And I let them
mm-hmm.
go through that. What do you think that is? And then when they find out, it's really that those 5 seconds that it takes to pull a trigger can get you 25 years. And young people don't think about what happens at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a saying in my organization, look at the end while you're at the beginning.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting when you consider that guns are more accessible than the computers and pencils and
absolutely.
Things of that nature. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Good point.
You know, there's young people who come home to a household and need a computer to do their homework and don't have it. But the brother in the other room has a gun under the mattress.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? So one of the things, you know, I don't like to just talk about the problem without talking about some possible solutions to this because parents oftentimes say, I read your mind.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm so used to trying to grab the moment when I have an opportunity to talk with young people and parents and teachers and you know, community people about this issue. It's so important that people understand that there is something you can do. This is not a place to throw up your hands and say, lock up all of the kids and just throw up your hands. I don't want to have nothing to do with them. This is the
right.
greater time to have everything to do with them. Be up on them, on everything that they're doing, like they coming out of you brand new again, like we did when they were babies. And we watched
right.
every move and waited for everything. We have to watch every move with our children because the pressure to become gang involved, to retaliate even when they're not gang involved, good kids pull triggers too. And so you
yeah.
see Rikers Island is filled with good kids that were bullied. And somebody said, you know what, my brother got a gun, I'm going to get him from under the bed, and you're going to shoot him. And that happens.
Mm.
That's for real. We got a kid right now doing 25 years upstate, and he was a student at Rice High School. And somebody touched his sister inappropriately.
Yeah.
And somebody
yeah.
else put the gun in his hand, and they kept saying, you know, they use language like you a pussy, you a this, you a that, and it's
yeah.
language that makes them feel less than and makes them go in a place of having to defend who they are by pulling
mm-hmm.
that trigger. And that's what this kid did, where he was going to go to college and he was interested in medicine. Now he's
mm-hmm.
doing 25 years in prison. Mm-hmm.
Which is,
so we
which
have
is a,
to talk about,
yeah.
you know,
so
the
you
consequences
talked about a lot of different circumstances. Yes, yes. You talked
mm-hmm.
about a lot of different circumstances. But I guess the thing that kind of stands out to me is when you talk about kids who are really in need, right, who might not
mm-hmm.
have the support they need at home, who might
yeah.
be having an emotional issue or a psychological issue, or whatever it is, but kids who are really in a higher level of need. And I'm wondering, how do you impact those kids? How are you able to reach them and help them navigate whatever circumstances they're dealing with? Because sometimes, you know, you have to deal with the circumstances before you can really reach a child.
Oh, absolutely. Or at least
yeah.
acknowledge that those things exist, right?
Uh-huh.
So we have
uh-huh.
young people who walk into our office, but not just the office. Before we had this office, we were on the street. We're still on the street. People think we have the office, and we're not on the street. Street Corner Resources is still on the street. We have a van, and now we have a mobile unit that will be rolled out by April, where we'll be pulling up in different neighborhoods at different times of the day and night. But the way that we reach young people is really to kind of meet them where they are. We have two music studios, and while I know almost nothing about producing music, but I know that young, like when our engineer was absent and the kids said, well, Miss Aisha, you know how to engineer. I said, no, baby, I don't. And they couldn't believe it. And they said, well, why did you get this music studio? I said, so you all would have a place to come. So for me, the music studio is kind of like the spider web. It's the place to catch them. Right, and, then,
mm-hmm.
and for us, it's also the carrot to dangle in front of them and say, hey, meet me at the studio, so that we have those conversations that are not easy to have, that most of the time when young people are on the street, they're very guarded. But when you bring them into a place like a music studio, you talk about music, and then you can ask the question like, so what's up? How you doing? And a lot of times they'll be like, yo, I'm all right. And I say, I understand they beefing over there where you live. And that's sometimes all you have to say, and they begin to start telling you stuff they may not tell you just on the street. And then they'll start talking about how they're connected to it or not connected to it, and you know, and they begin to reveal. And sometimes, you know, most of the time, I'm able to get them to be more comfortable through having conversations about need. So whatever
mm-hmm.
it is that they need. Yo, Miss Aisha, I need a job. Or they'll be talking to my staff and they'll say, you know, I need to get some training. I want to be a plumber or I want to be an electrician, but I don't think I'll ever be that. And we take the I don't think I'll ever be that to start looking at how you can become that and validating them, because that says that they don't feel valid enough to be that. So that we have to work on with them on validating who they are, small successes, and just stay in constant contact. So our team talks to our street team, the Speak Peace Forward team, talks to young people. They check in the day, and then they check in the afternoon, and before we close out at night, they check in with what we call our participants. And those are the young people who have the highest potential to be involved in shooting. Like, they're not just high risk or at risk. These are young people who have the highest potential to shoot. And what some folks don't know is that those kids live in a lot of very common households, some households with two parents, and folks are not paying attention that the shooter is, the possible shooter is living in their house because they don't see the signs of what comes forth before a kid pulls the trigger. Because, you know, the trigger is pulled long before the trigger is pulled. So by the time the kid pulls the trigger, there were a series of things that were showing up that were not paid attention to. I'm sorry, say that again.
What are the signs? What should people be looking for?
You know, and some of them are very simple. You know, young people who would normally come home and kind of hang out in the house and watch TV, and or they had one set of friends and they would all go play basketball and go to the movies together, stuff like that, like normal young people stuff. Then you begin to see that behavior change. You begin to see the attitude of the young person that used to listen to his parent, and now everything, they're rebelling against everything. They change the time that they come in. Oftentimes, they're not coming home. They stay out all night. They start drinking. They start flagging. Flagging is wearing the colors of the gang, so it's usually those handkerchiefs hanging out of the pocket, wrapped around the head, wrapped around the neck or the wrist, the arm, stuck in the pocket of the jean jacket. But, you know, some parents just kind of don't see that, or they might say, well, why are you wearing that rag around your head, but not even asking, going deeper than that, because they don't really know that much about gang activity. The friends change.
Right.
They don't bring the friends home anymore. You know, next thing you know, they're hanging out with Day-Day in them. And so you only see Day-Day when he's calling out the window, but he doesn't show up in your living room to sit to have a conversation. And that's why I always, parents that will be listening, they need to know, invite your children's friends, not just your sons, your daughters too, because girls are entering the prison at a faster rate than young men right now. So you want to engage your kids in a different kind of way. I don't care what their friends look like, what they smell like, how they act. All of that is null and void if you have to bury a child, right? So the best thing to do is invite those kids and fix a little food sometime and then walk away. Let them eat. Say, you know, I got a little fried chicken right here. Y'all eat. And listen to the conversation. You have to listen to the conversation and then just have them, you know, come back at different times. Say, next week I'm going to make y'all something more. Friday. And they will begin to get more and more comfortable. You'll hear more and more of the conversation, and you will know what direction your child is going in that's different from where they were going before. And then that's the time you have to do an intervention. That's where we also come in. If parents are not sure, they're hearing language like, yo, I got to get that gat. Can you hold that gat, the hammer, whatever they call in the gun, because it's different words for the gun. You have to listen so that you begin to hear the language, and then, you know, you can always call us to help decipher that language. But a lot of times when they start speaking a different language, and I don't mean a second language like Spanish or French, when they start speaking a language in English that you don't understand and it's in your household, it's time to really investigate. Language you don't understand, different way of dressing, different way of being, different friends, changing the times
it's
that they come in, and changing behavior.
Well, it's, you know, the difficult part of what you just said, though, is that all of that sounds like typical adolescent behavior. You know what I mean? So I imagine it would be hard for parents to discern between what's a red flag and what's just a phase in an adolescent's life.
Right. So
that's
where, you know, you usually if a kid is a young person, I hate to say kid, young person is involved in the life, in the gang life, or moving in that direction, it's a little different from just adolescent behavior. Now, it's not just the wannabe, it's the change in a number of things, and usually around the same time. So they change the dress, they change the friends, all of that is kind of more grouped. Whereas in regular adolescence, you kind of take on, you want to be like Squeaky, you want to act like, dress like Cookie. You know, we went through that. It's a different kind of thing. And so I would just say to parents and grandmas and aunties and, you know, the neighbors, usually you will know what you're looking at. You will feel, it feels different, you know, than it does just like adolescence. So, and if you're not sure, you know, anytime that there's doubt, you need to be concerned, because just the fact that you are feeling uncomfortable with the way that they're presenting themselves, and I'm not talking about the fact that they're not dressed up or dressed up, but that they're acting different as well, then it's, mm-hmm. it's a good time to have a conversation with people who do this work. And so Street Corner Resources, our telephone number is 212-694-8759, 212-694-8759, and we have a credible clinician. His name is Maurice Lacey. He's a licensed social worker, and he's also available. We have a team, the Speak Peace Forward team, that's on the street. They're young people, so they're very connected to the language and all that goes with young people being gang involved. And so we have them as well that, we come out, they're welcome to come here. They can make a phone call and just say, well, I want to know what it means when they start talking about the hammer. I can clearly say to a parent they're talking about the gun. So you have to use your resources, and if you're not sure, but there's a reason for you to suspect something, that's reason enough to talk to someone.
Sister Sakou, I grew up in the 60s, and there was a program there called How Are You?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And in that program, and one of the things I see that's missing today is, see, we had a venue to go to keep us off the street. And
that's
I particularly
right.
remember there was a young man who came, and I call him young. He was probably my age, but he wasn't involved mm-hmm. in the program. And some kind of way, he started coming around, How Are You? His name was War God Fox. You hear what I'm saying? War God Fox. But once he started communicating with us, especially the young people, he got a job and started working. He got the education that he didn't get in school at How Are You.
That's
changed
right.
his whole perspective on life. Matter of fact,
that's
he
right.
used to live with Livingston Wingate for a while. I'm telling you. And
he
I look around.
He calling himself War God Fox?
Yes. Yeah. He had a real name.
Lord have mercy.
But all the things that we had, those pieces that, you know, I don't know if you remember how the money came to Harlem, but Adam Clayton Powell got Congress to come up with $118 million to deal with.
That was the manpower. Wasn't that manpower?
No, we came first. Manpower got money from How Are You. But, that, but Manpower did get money out of the same bill. Certainly did.
Okay.
And
okay.
one of the things that happened as a result of that is that we had programs. You know, Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was in our program. He wanted to play saxophone. We had we had journalism. We had sculpture. We read books. We had a book to read every week, Crisis Black and White, the Spook Who Sat by the Door, all those books
relative
to our community. That is so sorely missing, because if we had that today, we could deal with a whole lot of these issues. But all of a sudden now, money is a problem. It's not a problem for other communities, but it's a problem for us.
And I'm glad that you said that, because money is a problem because we as a community, and I'm sad to say, and not to beat up our community, it's really a pull up and not a beat up, is that we became complacent. With somebody else is going to take care of the problem. There's no savior coming. Nobody else is going to take care of the problem. The problem is ours. And the deep thing is we have enough masterminds in our community, people who come from back in the day and knew and built some things, and then young people coming up, these millennials that are very well educated, that know how to write, and know how to do a whole host of other things with technology. And if we pool our resources, if we support each other in the efforts that we have, like Image Nation and the film and getting young people out to see films and having discussions and coming to Street Corner Resources and creating music in our two music studios or performing at the Peace Cafe, we have some things in our reach. Do we need more? Yes. Do we need more money with the programs that we have? Yes, we do, so that we all can, build. We don't want to just stay one-faceted. We can begin to build, and there's a whole host of other things, like you said. Young people could not just be playing basketball, reading books, having a book club, preparing for college, playing tennis.
And you know what?
culture.
I would love to see, you know, HCCI has a film program where we're teaching young people to write, to make films. And I would love to see a collaboration between this film program and your program.
Yes.
You know, or maybe.
That would be great.
Yeah, so we're in it right now, but we start another cycle in the fall. And so we definitely should make sure that we connect your teens to the filmmaking program that we offer. What we do is we teach them to make the films, and then at the end of the year, they get to premiere with Image Nation in the park. And so I think, you know, we need to tie all of the resources together so that we can really make it something that, you know, all facets of the community are participating in. So in the fall, we're going to get your kids in the HCCI filmmaking program.
Let me add this. Also workforce development. So kids who are interested in going to construction and things like that, we need to hook up all those things with HCCI. And I think we can do a magnificent job in terms of bringing resources to a community.
Absolutely. And, you know, Street Corner Resources has a program that they're working with in the Polo Grounds. It hasn't yet fully developed.
I've attended several meetings with Brother Muhammad Kareem.
Oh, right. Okay, so then you understand
but the
that,
listeners
right.
don't know. Tell us about it.
So the program is the INSTAP program, so Street Corner Resources participates in that. We have the contract in the Polo Grounds to provide supportive services to the group, people living in the Polo Grounds, but there's also a group that will be making plans for things that they like to see happen in the Polo Grounds in terms of, you know, the environment, the lighting, and all of that. Mm-hmm. Along with that, Street Corner Resources will be bringing the Peace Cafe and workshops and things like that and coming together as a community to build the Polo Grounds stronger, to make the appearance of it, you know, more vibrant, and to kind of get the spirits of people a little more lifted, you know, because you can see by the way that the Polo Grounds is looking, and no put down to the Polo Grounds, but that people can't feel that great when they see garbage on the ground and garbage being thrown out the window and no activities going on for young people. So we plan to help to improve with the help of the people in the Polo Grounds and, of course, all of the neighboring organizations and businesses.
One of the things you said that that I didn't realize that I think is actually mm-hmm. wonderful. How, I mean, I know you're providing programs for the youth, but it sounds like you're also a resource for the parents, and in a sense, you're embracing the whole family.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how adults can interact with you who might be in need? I mean, you did a little bit already, but
okay,
I just didn't know that
one
that
of
part
the ways
existed.
That, yeah. So one of the ways that adults can interact with Street Corner Resources is, one, we have a credible clinician. Oftentimes parents are overworked, they're frustrated, they don't know what to do with their children, and sometimes what they do becomes more harmful than good because of their frustration level. They may be calling the child names or fighting with the child. Street Corner Resources is a place where that parent can come in and talk, make an appointment to talk with our licensed social worker and just have some regular meetings on a weekly basis to begin to plan and figure out how they could have better interaction, how they can better take care of themselves. The other things that we do, we have the Peace Cafe the last Friday of every month, and that's located at 233 West 140th Street, 140th Street. And that's entertainment, and it's open mic. Folks come from a lot of different places, very peaceful. It's family-oriented, so a mother could come with her son or daughter, and it just gives people an opportunity to have an outlet. They don't have to dress up, and they don't have to pay to get in, and they usually have a great time. They can dance and laugh. Laughter's always good for the spirit. And so what we try to do is really try to create community so that those same people that come to the Peace Cafe know that they can come to this office and talk to somebody if they need to. So we're all about building relationships, engagement, 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 and then also, you know, keeping the willingness to help parents to problem solve. And so sometimes, you know, it may be one of the younger people, the parent comes in and they say, I just need to talk to somebody, maybe the social worker's not here. The team will listen, the street team will listen and try to give as much positive feedback quickly as they can, and until they can get to the social worker. So we're here to help. Street Corner Resources is here to help.
That's so important because, you know, they don't come with instructions.
No, they don't.
The parents are really at their wit's ends, especially if you're working long hours and you're doing everything you can do to provide for a child. But there's a point where we don't have those resources. So that's really just invaluable to the community.
You know what? Another detriment is the fact, you know, I haven't been talking about this a long time, but a lot of those households are fatherless.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no defense to come anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, don't you have an office on 145th, like less than a block away from the National Action Network?
Yes. We have our administrative office as well as our Cure Violence home base is located at 151 West 140th Street. And we are a ways down from the National Action Network, but on the same block on a different side of the street. We're right across the street from the mobile gas station.
Okay. So you have
and
two
locations? And,
of course,
we always partner with the National Action Network on a variety of things. You know, we try to give supportive services. We try to share resources when we can. And, of course, we participate in some activities at the National Action Network.
Okay. Now, I ask these questions, this particular question, just because I know how difficult it is to build an institution and to get everything in place so you can have staff, so you can actually, you know, realize your full vision. And so you've gone from street-level interventions to now having a mobile van and two offices in Harlem where you can provide services, and you're providing services off-site in other locations. Tell us a bit about the process and the growth and how you made all this happen, because people think it's easy. They don't recognize that, you know, it takes – you've been doing this for 20 years, and in the last – 5 years or so, you're getting these more physical
some traction. That's right.
Right. So tell us how that happened for you.
One, I'm glad that you said and understand that it's not easy, because I think when folks see me, they say, "Oh, I need you to help me get my organization started," and that lets me know that they really don't understand what this takes.
You're not ready. Right?
they're not ready to do this. Most folks who say they tell me they want a not-for-profit organization, but most folks are really not ready to put in the kind of work that it takes. So it's a 24/7 job. You have to keep turning the wheel and turning the wheel and having your vision and holding your vision and holding your vision in spite of other people being able to see it, because you'll get more naysayers sometimes then you get help. But if you stay steady, the help appears. You begin to see where the help is. And you begin to read more. You know, I know I began to read more about getting funding and grants, and we don't have a lot of money. But understanding how that grant process works, how applying for funding with the city council. And then, you know, I always like to talk to people who are of like mind. If somebody already did this, in some way or some part of this, then I need to acknowledge that intelligence and be okay with being the student. And that has helped me a lot, because, you know, sometimes I call people and I say, okay, I need help. I need you to explain this to me if you got a moment. And most of the time people want to be the help. They're not going to want to do everything for you, but when they see that there's a willingness to make things happen, they don't mind helping you, rather than me just saying, I need you to get my program started for me. Nobody was going to do that. I had to do that. And it meant just, you know, every day staying on purpose and supporting other folk who are doing different kinds of work, and just beginning to see how they operate, the value in their work, and then also looking at people as a resource. You know, there are so many people in our community that know so many things. And I began to make those people my go-to people. And finally, at that time, it was City Council woman Inez Dickens who really understood, began to understand my vision around the issue of violence and looking at eliminating that. And she funded the I Am Peace Music Studio at Harlem Renaissance High School, where Street Corner Resources still have an office. We've been there, this is going on 8 years, and we put a music studio into that school. And then she began to fund us for Cure Violence. And, you know, the rest is history. We just keep trying to build and add more to our cadre of services so that we can better serve the community.
That's awesome. So Sister Inez, or Councilwoman, now State Assemblywoman.
State Assemblywoman, that's right.
Yeah. Big supporter of yours. Who else has supported you? Because I know that you did. And I ask this because, I think it's important for people to know, first of all, that government agencies are there to help us and that we have to tap in and make them do their job. But also that you can also tap deeper into your community, right? Because I heard there's a local real estate developer that helped you do the had that tremendous presentation during the Harlem the African American
Community
Day
Board,
right?
Oh, yes. So that was
things like that. I think are important.
Yes.
You know, it's like a local
that
person
was
did Lamore, that.
Lamore Realty. He actually bought one of the floats for us, and the other came out of Cure Violence, and we had three floats. We pulled our resources with
you guys
with
were fantastic. I was like, no, I'm so excited to see what you did.
You know what we're doing?
The whole parade.
That's what they said. They said, Aisha, you took over the daggone parade. I said,
that's
well,
right.
Know, what we were trying to do was to bring peace, the message of peace, to the parade. So we told We had so much. I was like a kid at the parade.
Mm-hmm.
We had so much fun. We had tap dancers, hula hoopers, roller skaters. Lamore Realty paid for the T-shirts to get done and paid for one of the floats. And then we had Cure Violence paid for another one. So we wound up with three floats in the parade. And then we had our bus and we had the convertible and a few other convertibles. And you know, we had the kids tap dancing and rapping and shaking. We had so much going on. I couldn't see it all. But the good thing was the community was excited. We had people screaming, I am peace. And the whole idea is just to put that message and vibration in the air and make people excited about creating peace. But most of all, make other young people say, yo, I want to get on that float. Next year I'm going to be in the parade. And that's what we got a lot of. And so we're hopefully looking forward to this September. Like, everybody can just come on. We'll have T-shirts for everybody. If there's a particular organization and they need shirts, maybe they don't have the money to get them. If we have the resources, which I'm sure that we will, we'll have I Am Peace on the front and the name of their organization on the back. I told some people just cut the neck out, turn it around, or you know, because we can't always get them one and the other. And then just turn the shirt around. Like, whatever works. The message of peace has to be present. And as long as that's present, we'll do the shirts. We did some banners. We had a band, and we did their shirts and their banners. And that came from Street Corner Resources Cure Violence because they're one of our partner organizations. So it's really all about promoting the message of peace. And I think we were able to get that across and that you could have fun at a parade without having violent engagement. You know, it was like the parade was becoming synonymous with the violence, and we want to change that because that's not who we are. We took too much time to build this thing, you know. I forgot the older man that started it, the African-American Day Parade, but what we want is to build Harlem up. Build our people up, build our community up. We can come back to a peaceful place. And I think the parade is a good way to show that. So, yep, we took it over.
You did.
And we had our own microphones, so we were a mess.
Yeah. It was glorious. It's just like it should have been. You know, so you mentioned earlier that actually, we're going to get back to this. But you mentioned earlier that you've been doing this for a long time and you now kind of have a formula and a structure. So if anyone was to ask you, like, what is the structure, what is the formula, how would you summarize that?
Well, I would just say, and I don't know if I have the perfect formula or perfect structure, but what I kind of pride myself in, and, you know, in the beginning I said, you know, sometimes some people would say I'm a little crazy because, and I'm not saying crazy in a bad way. I'm saying it really kind of in a humorous kind of way because I'm willing to think outside the box and do some things sometimes that people wouldn't normally do, like the parade, like the way we did the parade with all of the different pieces moving and going. And even with thinking about, like, how to better access people on the street by having a mobile unit, you know, and going out right on the street and engaging young people. So I think the structure is to have structure, but sometimes be willing to kind of walk away from that structure just a little bit to try something new and bring it back to the structure,
yeah.
You know, to have some different kind of visions.
To be innovative.
You know? Yes, to be innovative, that's the word, yes, absolutely. And not be afraid to explore what attracts young people and let them come up with something. Like I tell young people here, I say, okay, so what else could we do that's like totally different from anything anybody else is doing? Or how can we do something that other folks are doing but do it in a different kind of way? And they start telling me stuff, you know. They were the ones that told me, they said, we need to put everything in the parade, like everything. I said, okay, here we go. So, and it was a lot of fun, and then the community was happy. So I just think that we just can't be afraid to try new things. We can't be afraid to have fun, even though the subject matter is very serious, that we have to break that whole negativity, the violence, and show young people that we can create something new, that it's all right if we say the word love. It's also all right if we laugh and hug each other. And we did so much hugging in the parade. Oh, my goodness. But all of those things help bring more to the programming that we do. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I answered the question or not.
that answer was just fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
HCCI is honoring you this year.
I'm excited.
Yes, we are so happy to be doing that on June 26th at Marina Del Rey. You're receiving, I think, one of our special community awards.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so excited to just be celebrating you and your tremendous work.
I'm excited too, trust me. Mm-hmm. And it was one day that I was thinking about, and I was like, oh, my God, I got to make sure I have the date on the calendar so I don't miss it, right?
And yes.
So the team and I. No, and that's exactly when I ran into Brother Lawrence. I said, I want to make sure that the date is not like next week. And so we put it on the calendar. The whole team will be there. We're excited.
Nice.
We'll be promoting. Probably we'll start promoting it on our social media platforms somewhere in May, probably the beginning of May. And so we'll be inviting people to join us and give them details on how to get tickets and so on and so forth. Because I believe that when I'm celebrated, so is my team, and then so is the community. There's so many people like you and others that support me and always give me, you know, kind words. And sometimes just the words is enough to take you through the next moment or day or hour or whatever it is. So
I know that's
I'm grateful. I'm grateful. And I'm grateful to be honored.
Grateful for
Thank
your work.
You so much. Thank you.
This has really been a wonderful conversation. I look forward to us doing it with you again. But before we go,
absolutely,
one question we have to ask. How can Harlem help you?
Wow. Okay, so the biggest help, and I know most folks would say, is the money. But I'm not going to say that. The biggest help is that anywhere that you see violence beginning to bear its ugly head, or even the places where violence begin, I need people in Harlem to interrupt that. And it doesn't mean you jump in front of a gun. What we see is that, you know, when we see things in our community, people are talking negative to each other, for somebody to say, Kings, come on now, let's come together. Or to just say to a young person that you see going the wrong way, is there something I can help you with? You were on my mind. Sometimes just saying you were on my mind makes that young person feel special. and important, and it's the conversation starter, and that keeps that young person away from violent behavior. And so wherever we can, we need to make sure that we don't promote violence on social media. Don't promote it by sharing it over and over and over again with friends or Instagram or Snapchat, and to encourage other young people to not participate in violence and to talk about the consequences of violence, like 25 years. And I'm talking particularly to those brothers and sisters who did time. The way that they can help, you know, you don't have to hide your background. Your background becomes the help for us. You know, if you've already been there and you did that and you did the time and you did solitary confinement and you missed your family and you weren't there for the burials and, you know, when, and funerals when people died because you weren't free, remind these young people how you lose your liberty, your freedom, when you participate in violence. And so really that's more of how I need Harlem to help. The other ways, if there are grant opportunities, if you want to donate, we're asking people not to donate on our website because it's under investigation right now, mainly because somebody is redirecting our website to another site. And they're collecting money, right? So I wanna, I'm putting that out there and being transparent about it because people have donated, and it doesn't come to us.
That's not up.
I'm sorry?
That's why your website's not up right now.
Absolutely. And so we're working on that. It should be up. But if they are interested in donating, our office is at 151 West 145th Street. You can always call. We can tell you the best way to either send a check. And I think we have set up PayPal so they can ask for Brother Kareem Muhammad, and he can give them clear ways to donate. And if they want to volunteer, our doors are always open. They can come in and fill out a volunteer application, and we can always use help with our Peace Cafe. We'll be taking the mobile unit to the streets, so we need a volunteer team that we're beginning to build for that, and they can actually engage people, helping people with resumes and resources and things like that, and they can be part of that team. So there's a whole host of ways people can help. But the main thing
need people.
Yes, we are. We're on Facebook at Street Corner Res, on Facebook at Street Corner Resources, and on Instagram at Street Corner Res. And then we also have Twitter. Am I correct, Tanae? Twitter? We're on Twitter. You know, the young people take care of the social media. And they're doing a pretty good job. So like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Like my colleague here said, we hope that we'll have another conversation with you again soon, and we'll see you at the gala, and I'll see you in the park.
I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it all. Enjoy the rest of you all's day, and thank you both so much for having me on the show. Peace and blessings.
Take care.
Dreams can come true.